so many people just go through the system, and parents and people just think, well, it worked for me. I mean, I was fine. I made it. Like, that's where learning happens. You need to send your kid to an institution for learning to happen. They need to be with a teacher. They need to be with other kids. They need to go up levels. It's sort of like this narrative that we've had for so many years, and people just keep justifying it because they never really stop to ask why.
Yeah, we just assume what's worked okay can just keep going along.
Right. Exactly. And but here's, you know, there's so many things that we're noticing, like the kinds of jobs that we were training kids for in the past didn't quite require for you to think differently, or for you to sort of like come up with new solutions to old problems or things like that. Like, it didn't require that. It was sort of like facts, and you had to memorize and know a few specific things so that you could work at these factories and so that you could do. And but it's no longer like that. Like, right now we really need, you know, and especially, well, based on everything we've seen, like, our world is very unpredictable, full of chaos. Everything's constantly changing. So if anything, we need to, you know, be preparing kids that are adaptable, that are able to stop and think for themselves and you know, spin in a different direction and figure things out on their own. And this is not what schools are training kids to do. You know, schools are sort of like teaching you to think a specific way, follow instructions, and believe what everyone, you know, this is the truth, don't really question things. And we think, you know, we're always striving to be correct or to be right and to sort of go in this direction, but really we're not encouraged to try different things out and fail in the process. And that's really what life is about.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is all about the future of education for kids. My guest is Ana Fabrega, an edupreneur and former teacher known by little ones as Miss Fab. She's currently the chief evangelist of Synthesis School, an innovative online enrichment club started by the director of Elon Musk's experimental school at SpaceX. They help students build decision-making and problem-solving skills through games. And after listening to this conversation, you'll understand why the current education system needs an overhaul, the skills we should be developing in kids, ideas we need to unlearn from the traditional schooling system, the role that technology can play in learning, forest schools, micro schools, and alternatives for parents to consider, how games can be good for your kids, the Lindy effect, and ideas that will stick around in education for some time, the difference between remote and online education, and a list of recommended books for kids. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and she's at AnaFabrega11. Details of that in the show notes. And if you're new here, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcast app. You can watch all of these episodes visually on youtube.com/creatorlabfm as well. Now let's get straight into the show. Ana, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Bilal, for having me.
Yeah, I've been seeing your stuff all over the internet. You've been doing some really interesting work over the last few years. But the focus of today's discussion is really going to be about the future of kids' education. So something that all of us really care about, whether we have kids or not. For a lot of us, like myself, I don't have kids yet, but I hope to one day. And it's something that will be useful to dig into. So before we get into all of the details of that and the future of education, let's go back a little bit and paint a picture of kind of where you are, how you got to where you are today. So I know you've got like an international background. You grew up in Panama, it sounds like, but all over the world you were traveling around because of your dad's job. So take me back to some of those, like what were some of the countries like and where did you land?
Yeah. So I'm originally from Panama. That's where I was born. But like you said, due to my dad's job, he worked at a multinational corporation. Since I was a month old, we started to bounce around and move to different countries. And we would typically stay in each country for about 2 to 3 years, some exceptions. So I really just grew up with this mentality of I'm always the new girl. I'm always, you know, going to be moving and meeting different people. So change was sort of like the only constant growing up for me and my sister. I have a younger sister. So we moved to Colombia when I was about a month old. And then we moved to Venezuela for a few years. Then to India, which was a pretty wild and different experience for us. And then we moved to Mexico for a few years. Then to Brazil. We lived in Rio de Janeiro. And then finally, we moved back to Panama when my dad retired, and I did high school in Panama. So I always talk, when I talk about my childhood, I say that, you know, when it comes to schools, I've been around the block a few times. I went to 10 different schools, you know, by the time that I was 15, I had already done that. So it really, I guess that at the moment, I didn't quite realize what that was like. But now, and with a lot of the work that I do, and I've had to reflect on my experience and really like what was driving me to do the work that I do today. And I do believe that my atypical childhood and learning experiences really were like a springboard to me wanting to transform a lot of teaching and learning. So yeah, it was a very interesting time. And it's curious because people will often be like, oh, well, no wonder you decided to become an educator, right? Like you went to all these schools, that's probably what costed. And actually, in retrospect, really, I don't remember a lot of my experience in school in these different countries. And it's interesting because I have a very good memory for this kind of stuff. But I don't remember my teachers. I don't remember my classmates in many cases. I don't remember what I was learning. I don't even remember the field trips, which is usually things that are very vivid for kids. But I do remember very vividly everything that happened outside school. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was very fortunate to have a stay-at-home mom who tried to frame everything as an adventure, right? So she would really value everything that was happening outside of school and the learning that was happening outside of school. And it made me sort of like really realize that that's what really matters.
That's amazing. Yeah. So 7 countries, 10 schools, from Venezuela, Panama, Colombia, all the way to India and back. Pretty incredible. I'm curious because you mentioned India and my family is Pakistani Indian. So I'm curious, like, where were you and what was that like? Because it sounded like the one that stood out the most.
Yeah. So we lived in New Delhi. We were there for about a year and a half. We ended up leaving, my mom, my sister, and I, and my dad stayed for a few more months. But, well, it was very different because we didn't speak English yet. Oh. And then we were moving to India. We obviously did not speak the language either, but it was the first time that we were going to an American school. And I think I was 9 years old, and it was just such an interesting time where I was trying to communicate with kids from different countries because I went to an American school there. And I asked my mom, I was like, how did I not feel this? I had so many friends and I loved, you know, being around and talking to people, but I didn't really speak the language. So, and she was like, oh, you figured it out. Like you picked up on things pretty quickly. I've always been very personable, very social. Being the new girl was actually a good thing for me because I loved it. I was very excited to meet new people. And I guess that India was the place where my parents really tried to take us to different places within India so I could learn about different cultures and really experience life from a very different perspective from where I was coming from. So I remember all those field trips that I did with my parents and my sister. And it was just very, it opened my eyes to a different reality than we live.
I mean, the US already is so different in different parts. Like you've lived in New York, you're now in Miami, it looks like. Very different worlds just between those two cities, but going from even Panama to Venezuela to like very different worlds, I'm sure. So that's really incredible to lay that foundation. Let's fast forward a bit because now you're Ana Fabrega on the internet. A lot of people follow you for your takes on education and the work that you're doing there. But a lot of people know you as Miss Fab, right? Which is your teacher name and what kids might have called you. So talk to me about that time being a teacher, because you're not someone who's just working on this now abstractly. You've actually been in the classroom teaching kids.
I went to ed school. I went to NYU in New York, and I decided to major in childhood education and special education. I also wanted to work with kids that had different disabilities and sort of figure out what that was like. And then I minored in psychology. So it was a really good program, and we had a lot of time in the field, student teaching, observing teachers. But that's when I started to realize that a lot of the theory and the things that we were learning to become teachers or to be teachers weren't really in line with the things that I had learned as a kid. And then when I was in the field observing, and we got to see like the best teachers out there in practice and doing, you know, the best kind of teaching, I would really see the same issues that I saw when I was growing up in all these schools, a big lack of engagement. The schools are very focused on you know, what the kid, the specifics of what the kids are learning, and not focused enough on whether the kids are learning at all or what kind of attitudes they're developing toward learning. It was just like a mismatch between what we were learning and my preparation and then what I was actually seeing in the classroom. So I finished my studying, and then I went on to having my own classroom. And I said, well, you know, I've seen sort of like what in theory works and what we've learned in the textbook, but I'm going to try to do things my way and sort of be this role model that my mom was for me when I was growing up, and just focus on the things that the kids are already excited about and curious about, and then see how I can push them a little bit further with that, or, you know, spark some new ideas. And that was sort of like what I wanted to do when I decided to become a teacher. I quickly realized, like many educators out there, that this is very challenging and difficult to do in a classroom when you're under this, you know, institution that we have all these things that we need to do and like standards that we need to meet and tests that we need to constantly be preparing kids to do, and all this curriculum we have to cover. So I didn't really have time to do the things that I thought that were really important. And I was sort of getting discouraged when I would see the attitude in my students when I had to do all this stuff that I didn't even know why I was teaching them that, or why I was enforcing these things. Like, it didn't really make sense. So I did that for 5 years until suddenly, you know, it became evident, like, this is just not the best use of my time. And I started to reconsider my role as an educator. I still wanted to work with kids, and I still wanted to be in the teaching profession and education. But I just really felt like there was a better way to do it, and better learning experiences that kids would actually want to be part of. And I started doing some research, and I started doing what I do best, which is ask tons of questions. This is also something that my parents encouraged when I was very little. They would let me question and question and question everything. And when you start to question, you know, why do we do things the way we do them in education, or where did this ideas come from, you will quickly realize that a lot of it comes from a system that was created 200 years ago for a very different time, for a very different purpose. And we are still carrying over a lot of the practices and these outdated approaches, even though everything, you know, our economy has changed, the kind of jobs that the kids are having have changed. We have lots of research that shows that a lot of these practices that we have been doing for years are not effective, are not productive, they're not even ethical in many cases, yet we continue to do them just because it's an institution that's been established for so many years, and we just carry on with what we've always done. So when I decided to leave the classroom, I had three options. I was like, well, I can either be one of those educators that tries to make changes within the system, or be those that try to press for changes, you know, outside the system, but sort of like more involved in politics and policymakers. And I wasn't really interested in that. Or I could, you know, seek alternatives outside and change outside the system. And that's sort of like where my head was at, because I realized that we would, you know, overcomplicate things when we're trying to think of what's a good education and what kids should be learning. And we come up with all these standards and all these metrics, and when really it's way more simple. If we like pause and just think, well, what do we know is true about kids and how kids learn? What do we know that are some of the skills that they're going to need right now to do the kind of jobs that they're interested in doing, right? And when you think about this, it's way more simple than we make it. So I was like, I'm not going to be able to come up with anything like this within the system. So I'm going to go venture out and try to see who's sort of doing the same thing as I am, and what can we create that is more in line with the needs that we have today.
I want to hone into that problem statement you kind of talked about there. You talked about a legacy education system that's been around for hundreds of years and hasn't changed too much. It was built for factory workers, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that made sense back then, because that's what we were producing as an economy. I'm actually going to call out one of your tweets on this. And if you're watching on YouTube, we'll put this on the screen too. You said, how do we conclude that the best way to prepare kids for the future is to cluster them into a setting where they're organized by age into grades and enforce them to learn the same things at the same time, at the same pace, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week for 12 years, right? And that's just perfectly demonstrates, like, you know, we're used to doing that. All of us did that. And, you know, it's not to say it doesn't work at all, because of course, you know, we are, we've all learned in some way. Are there any other reasons why you think this is still the case? Is it just things haven't moved quickly enough in that world?
I mean, there are many, many reasons for this, but I think that one of the main reasons why, at least elementary and, you know, for younger kids, education hasn't quite evolved or changed, it's because it really works in the end of the day as a daycare, right? Parents, you know, most parents need to send their kids somewhere. They can't afford to stay at home. That's, I think, that one of the biggest obstacles that we have and why people have just said, okay, like all the other alternatives require a more flexible schedule. Also, the fact that so many people just go through the system and parents and people just think, well, it worked for me. I mean, I was fine. I made it. Like, that's where learning happens. You need to send your kid to an institution for learning to happen. They need to be with a teacher. They need to be with other kids. They need to go up levels. It's sort of like this narrative that we've had for so many years, and people just keep justifying it because they never really stop to ask why.
Yeah, we just assume what's worked okay can just keep going along.
Right. Exactly. And but here's, you know, there's so many things that we're noticing, like the kinds of jobs that we were training kids for in the past didn't quite require for you to think differently or for you to sort of like come up with new solutions to old problems or things like that. Like, it didn't require that. It was sort of like facts, and you had to memorize and know a few specific things so that you could work at these factories and so that you could do. And but it's no longer like that. Like, yeah. Right now we really need, you know, and especially, well, based on everything we've seen, like our world is very unpredictable, full of chaos. Everything's constantly changing. So if anything, we need to, you know, be preparing kids that are adaptable, that are able to stop and think for themselves and, you know, spin in a different direction and figure things out on their own. And this is not what schools are training kids to do. You know, schools are sort of like teaching you to think a specific way, follow instructions, and believe what everyone, you know, this is the truth. Don't really question things. And we think, you know, we're always striving to be correct or to be right and to sort of go in this direction, but really we're not encouraged to try different things out and fail in the process. And that's really what life is about.
Like, what are the skills you think we should be developing in kids? You mentioned a couple there. I think you said like problem solving, flexibility. I think from your work with Synthesis, play and like this curiosity that comes with play and creating things is maybe a part of that too. But yeah, if I was saying what are the skills that I should develop in the kids that I will have one day, hopefully, like, are there a few that really stand out to you?
I think that our world is highly, like the work that we do nowadays is highly collaborative, right? And it's interesting because you think, well, kids are in school and they're with other kids, so they're learning how to collaborate, but not really. Like, school really is like a single solo journey. You are surrounded by people, but there's very little opportunity to socialize and to work together in meaningful things and to, you know, bounce off ideas and sort of, in, you know, in debates and negotiate different, like, you don't really have a lot of that. And I've realized that, you know, the real world is very much like that. So, you know, how can we teach kids to think for the, like, come up with an idea and then try to justify their idea, but then also be willing to listen to other people and change their mind. And all this comes in working together. Like, it's all part of like, how do you work with other people? So that's a big one, like learning how to collaborate for now, for our times. Also learning how to communicate. Again, you would think that this happens in school, but kids have very chance to talk and to share their ideas. But it's crucial nowadays for people to be able to communicate both in the written word and, you know, in public and all these things. So teaching them how to find and develop their own voice in a competitive dynamic is really important. I think that perhaps the most important one is teaching kids how to learn on their own. Like, learning shouldn't stop the moment kids graduate from college. And a lot of them have this mentality. Like, in order for you to keep doing things and keep innovative and you know, doing amazing things, you need to keep learning. And kids don't know how to do this. They're used to sitting down and somebody telling them what to learn, what to do. You know, so when you leave them on their own and you're like, okay, now you need to continue learning on your own, they don't really know how to do this. So there's a big opportunity there to teach kids how to use all the resources that they have available nowadays with the internet and everything in order to learn on their own, then how to share their ideas with other people and what to do with that knowledge that you're gaining, how to create things and share them and iterate. So this is also something super important that kids need to be learning nowadays. And then I often talk about learning how to think, you can call it thinking from first principles. You can call it like being independent minded or learning how to think for yourself. But all this really requires teaching kids how to be a little bit skeptical. and you know, in school, or sometimes parents think like, well, but that's not a good thing because it's associated with a negative quality. But really, all that means is not believing everything that people tell you.
And like questioning things independently.
Exactly. And saying, you know, why is this way? Or why can't I do this? And suddenly you start to see a lot of possibilities when you do that, when you just dig in a little bit deeper. So teaching kids how to be a little bit skeptical and question things in a, you know, in an appropriate way, right? And also something that I've noticed that in school, we teach things like separate subjects, right? We sort of like compartmentalize, like, you know, this is reading is here, then math and this, but really like the way that I learn is like, I grab ideas from different areas and then combine them and sort of synthesize a message and then go on from there. So teaching kids how to do that, like how to think across disciplines and synthesize the information, that's all part of thinking creatively and thinking differently.
From your vantage point, like what sort of jobs are going to be there in the future that we need to train people on? So just to share from my point of view, a very limited amateur understanding, you know, we went from primary industries, which is basically like farming and stuff like that for a long time, to secondary, where we're manufacturing, to tertiary industries, which are services and knowledge work, essentially. I don't think necessarily the answer is everyone's going to be a coder one day either, right? Like that's the other extreme. But I think the word creating things, and obviously the name of the show is Creator Lab, it means like making things happen, like figuring out problems and then creating solutions. So I'm curious from your point of view, what are those sorts of jobs that we should be planning ahead for?
Instead of like giving you specific examples, like I like this quote, or I heard Naval Ravikant talking about this recently, which really resonates with this idea that we're talking about, which is that in the future, many, you know, automation is going to sort of like take over all the jobs that are not creative jobs. Mm. And again, creativity means different things for different people. Like in the past, we associated with art and music, but really, you know, you need to be creative to do many different kinds of jobs, right? And I think that this is perhaps like really what we should be focusing on right now, on preparing kids and developing creative thinkers and innovative thinkers that are able to, again, combine different ideas, to come up with new ideas, find novel ways to solve old problems, think outside the box, because those are the skills that are going to be required in many of the jobs. And if you ask kids nowadays, like, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? You will often hear like, oh, I want to be a YouTuber, or I want to be a creator. Like when I was younger, this content creator was not even a thing, right? Yeah. And now it almost seems like, you know, lots of people are becoming content creators, and it's such an exciting and thrilling job that younger kids really look up to, you know, sort of like the self-made, self-starters who are sort of like,
They're celebrities, right? For those kids, for sure.
Yeah, and if you think about it, those are the most meaningful kinds of work, the ones that really require something from you, not just following a set of skills and a set of things. So I think that we're moving toward more of those kinds of jobs, and therefore we really, you know, we need to be focusing and preparing kids for that. And schools are not focused on that. They're not worried about kids being more creative or more innovative or more, no, and I don't blame them. You know, I don't blame the teachers, for example, because they're, you know, they're worried about the kids passing the exams, right? Their salaries are tied to that. So they're worried about covering all the curriculum and all the standards and all. And it's crazy. Like I read a stat the other day that said that 2/3 of the jobs that we're preparing kids to do won't even exist when the kids are older. So it's like, what are we preparing them for? But I must say that I am feeling very optimistic because I've encountered a lot of people that are doing the heavy lifting and like lots of work in the alternative education space, and coming up with, you know, alternatives and other paths.
And what if that changes too, right? Because I think when, if you ask a kid when they're 7 years old, like, you know, 30 years ago, when we were younger, you know, the most common jobs people talked about at that age were like astronaut and like a pilot and stuff like that, which is great. And maybe a doctor or whatever. And over time that changes, even as a young adult, before the world changed so much. I think the recent answers to that same questionnaire, which you referenced earlier, were a huge proportion of kids said they want to be essentially a YouTuber or a content creator, which makes sense because that's what they're seeing. But also they're they will probably change their minds by the time they're 18, and maybe by the time they're 35 they might want to change again as well, which I think mm-hmm. is becoming more common. So I think you're right to say that what we're really trying to train society for in terms of education is problem solving, flexibility, finding your own voice, and the ability to keep adapting as the world adapts at that pace. Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring up this topic of the Lindy effect, where the longer a concept has been around, the longer it is likely to stick around in the future. So essentially, like these truths that probably will be around for a long time. And I know you've written about some of these, so I'd love to go into a few of these and explain why you think they're important and if they're still going to be around. The first one you mentioned was learning by doing. Why is that still such a fundamental part of education?
Yeah, so we as a species, right, like we learn by mimicry, like by, you know, by observing and then by doing, right? So a lot of this has been lost with time, as the teachers are sort of like the center of the classroom and they're the one imparting the knowledge, and it's very lecture based. And we think that, you know, by sitting down, kids are absorbing all this knowledge and just learning. That's not happening. The way, you know, kids don't learn like that. They learn when they actually are actively involved and like trying things out and, you know, failing in the process and then trying it again and actually doing it. So with time, we have seen a progression, you know, schools moving more toward like a student-centered approach. And you know, I must say that like schools have been evolving toward that. It's still not enough, in my opinion. So, and that's such a, you know, key component of learning, like actually being involved in doing it. So that's an idea that has been around for many, 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 many years, like even before schools were even invented, like that's how kids would learn. And we still see that that's effective nowadays. I also talk about like the Socratic method, which again dates back to like many, many, many years ago. And it's this idea of talking and having a dialogue and discussing the different things that you're learning, and not just, you know, accepting things, but questioning things and learning through questions, right? And through conversations. Again, very little opportunity for that in school. It's sort of like a monologue of the teacher. And so it's worked for many years. You do see some MBAs that, and some schools too, but like some MBAs that really have adopted this Socratic method approach, and it works really well because learning is a conversation in the end of the day, right? You're bouncing off ideas and changing your mind. I talk a lot about, you know, the third idea in the Lindy that I shared is blending education and entertainment. And to me, this is sort of like a no-brainer, because if you're not interested, you are not going to be learning, right? Like our mind holds on to things that we find meaningful and relevant, and we let go of the things that are not. Then the one, you know, the one-room schoolhouses, which are sort of the old version of what we're seeing now called micro schools or learning pods, many different names for this, but it's this idea of a smaller class, and it's usually like 5 to 8 like students with one teacher, one facilitator, and a very flexible curriculum, and sort of like learning about things that are, you know, that matter to their surroundings. So not from like a fixed curriculum and with standards, and but rather like, well, you know, more flexible in that sense. And then the last one is the role of the educator, of the teacher. Like in the past, it was more of a facilitator. Like the teachers weren't expected to have all the answers, but rather they were like instigators. They would post different questions that would get you thinking and that would get you like wanting to learn a little bit more and steer you in the right direction. And that's sort of like an idea that we should preserve nowadays, right? And that changed drastically with when education became compulsory in the 18th century. But I think that we're starting to move back to that again, of the teachers being more of a secondary role and the students being more of the protagonist of the learning experience.
To go into that example you talked about, entertainment, I'm curious if there's an example that comes to mind of the best examples of entertainment and learning for young kids that you've seen. I know we're going to get onto synthesis a little bit later, which is what you've been working on more recently.
The big word here is play. You know, humans, but especially kids, like that, you know, we're wired to learn through play. That's just how it works. Like, and actually, like the biological progression of learning is you first explore with a concept, you then play with it, and then you add rigor. That's sort of like the way that learning goes. Forcing kids to learn doesn't work. So when you make learning mandatory, you're removing those like exciting elements of play from it. So automatically something shuts down in your brain and you're not drawn to it. But when you approach it from a lens with a playful attitude and you know, you're trying to figure something out and like a game, kids get really excited. And when they get excited and they get into something, they're more likely to come back again. And that's when learning starts to stick. So an example that I'm going to use is where I'm working now. Like I recently joined an edtech startup called, well, it's not really an edtech startup. It's more like a gaming and learning startup. It's called Synthesis. And I decided to join because I was fascinated when I saw kids' reaction to the sort of games that they were playing. We use different game or like a game-based approach to hook the kids. And it's sort of like a means to an end, right? Like our purpose is not to entertain kids because they have a bunch of that. They can play video games for that or they can watch TV or whatever. But what we do is we create games with the sort of problems that we want kids to be solving and they're real problems. And we add several wrinkles of complexity. And I can talk about that also in a moment, but to make it really engaging and interesting to the kids. And the kids are learning things that they're not learning in school. So we teach them things like mental models. We teach them things like game theory, how to make decisions, how to solve problems in collaboration, how to think in the moment, how to switch gears, things like that, that we talked about earlier that are going to be crucial for the future of work. But they're doing it all through game simulations that we uniquely design with specific purposes in mind. And the kids are all over these games. Like it's incredible the levels of engagement and it's all done online. And the biggest thing that we hear from parents is like, wow, if you compare this lesson to another online lesson that our kids are now going through, the kids in a regular online lesson, they're very passive, they're bored, they're not active, they're sort of like looking. But when they're in Synthesis, because it's a game and because they're so into it, like they're at the edge of their seats and they can't contain themselves and they're very active, even though they're sitting down in front of a computer. That to me was just incredible. And so this word gamification, right? You hear it a lot, like we've seen it everywhere. But there's a difference between making a game that's designed to teach you something and grabbing something in school and just try to pointify it or add points or add like a little reward. And then you call that gamification. That's not really gamification. What you're doing is you're having kids do exactly what you wanted them to do and you're adding points or adding levels.
It's not built from the ground up with the dynamics of the game. Yeah,
exactly. So for it to really work, it has to be designed already as a game. And that's what we uniquely do at Synthesis. And so we have like a bunch of games that we have lined up that we are creating with specific things we want to teach them. And it's working really well. The kids are, you know, it's the first time in a long time that I see kids excited about learning and finishing a class and asking, okay, well, what can I learn more about this? So to me, that's the first step for learning to happen. And a lot of what's happening in education is sort of like a crisis in engagement, right? And this sort of seems like a solution. I'm not saying it's for everyone, but it's definitely working for the kids that we're working with. So that's sort of an example.
I'm just going to call out one of your tweets again that you've written about in the past, which is, kids who play video games know what real engagement feels like. They suffer the most in school because they know exactly what they're missing. And I thought that was really succinctly put, because even just thinking as myself, as an N of one, at school, I was incredibly hyperactive with learning. Like I was a pretty good student overall, but not necessarily because I was following the rules. It was more so, you know, the teachers that did best were the ones who were discussing, sharing stories, doing the Socratic method, like you said, and I could follow along. And now 20 plus years later, I know I can listen to 6 hours of podcasts a day and follow a conversation all day. But at the time, someone was reading a book out to me and I couldn't follow anything. So that's a whole different thing about like learning styles. But I thought the game part was really interesting, because at that age, if you told me I could play a game and I was learning, you know, I would be like, wow, just sign me up. And in hindsight, there probably were games that I played as a kid that definitely had an impact on me. And I'll give one fun example. You're from, you know, you've lived in South America as well, so maybe you're a soccer fan as well. But for me, I grew up playing football and watching football in the UK. There's a game called Football Manager or Championship Manager back in the day, and I would play that for like 10 hours a day. And it was just browsing different players and pretending to be the manager. But you're looking at data all day. And now for many years, my job was to look at numbers and quickly understand the trends and say, this is an action I can take. And I genuinely think a lot of that came from my ability playing that game for many years. Mm-hmm. And maybe it wasn't designed for that purpose, but I have a feeling it made an impact. So let's go into a few examples of what else you would like to design, you know, an ideal education system for. I've got a few guiding posts here, and tell me if any of these kind of like resonate with you or what you think about them. So the first one is allowing for individuality. I think that's probably quite important, both in terms of level but also interest. So like if you had a magic wand to wave, like what are some of the things you'd be thinking about around designing for individuality for kids?
Yeah, so this is a very big question, right? And I don't think that I have a specific answer, but the way that I thought about it is, we hear a lot like, oh, we need to personalize learning and we need to do this at scale. And that's very challenging if we try to only use one approach. So I tweeted recently that the only solution that I see to this big problem that we have with education is, you know, really having a variety of approaches, right? We talked about how all the kids are different. We have different learning styles. Also, families have different circumstances depending on where you are. So not everyone can, you know, I don't think that like homeschooling is for everyone. I don't think that learning through a game-based approach is for everyone. I don't think that the traditional system is for everyone. So I just think that it, you know, it depends on the kid, the family, the circumstances. But a few things that I do believe that we're going to start, you know, that are fair to say that the world is moving that way and in an ideal world, right, is I think that we're finally understanding that learning has to be way more student-centered and student-driven, and that there's a big power in self-directed learning. Like what you just mentioned, that was you picking up on things that you chose to play this game because you were interested. So you opted in and you started to learn different things that you now realize that you're using, right? By reflecting, you're like, oh wait, I probably got this from skill from the game. So it goes back to this idea, what I was talking about at the beginning, that my mom taught me that, you know, learning comes from everywhere, not just from this institution. So it's like starting to realize that everything that you do, you're learning from it. So trying to find the learning and the value on that. So definitely that. I think that it's also, education is going to be way less institutionalized. And when parents ask me like, well, give me some tips, I'm always like, if you can, try to stay away from big institutions. I know that people tend to think like, oh, those are the best facilities and the ones that have the, you know, most amount of money to give you all these programs and all this. Yeah, but it also comes with a lot of rules and standards that need to be met and you know, rigor and competition. And again, that removes the elements that really matter when it comes to learning. So, you know, less institutionalized and more like the micro schools that I was talking about, like smaller, more like in your neighborhood, depending on your needs at the moment. I also think that it's going to be, kids are going to have, and I'll, you know, after I talk about those sort of like key criteria that I think are going to be, then I'll give you an example of how I see it perhaps happening. So also kids having a lot of downtime during the day. And I know that we sort of associated learning and, you know, doing well with adding more, more, more and doing so many things and packing kids' schedules with like classes and then tutors and then this, when in reality, if you look at the research, the more, you know, less is more. Like if you have less time, you know, with instructions, and then you have more time to just sit down and reflect and sort of like internalize what you learned, and free time to explore things that you're interested in, not in a measured environment when people are like judging you, but just like freely dig into the things you're interested in. That's what I mean by downtime. So I think that more and more people are starting to realize that and value that. So I think that in the future, yeah, there is going to be like, let's say in the afternoons, a lot of downtime for kids to just sort of like explore their interests and do things that they're interested in. I also think that we are going to be moving more toward a lot of what happens right now is that we're following curriculums that are, not only are they outdated, but they're filled with information that I don't even know when you're going to need this. And there's so much research that shows that, you know, we retain only what we use in the productive world in the next 14 days. So if we teaching something, even if it's theoretically interesting to you, if you don't use it in the next 2 weeks, but like not like filling in a worksheet or doing a test, like that's not really using it, but using it in the real world to solve a real problem or to make a decision or anything, then you're probably going to forget it. So a big problem with, you know, why kids don't remember things in school is because we're teaching things just in case they ever need them in the future. A much better approach is to teach what I call on demand, which is you know, there's certain fundamental skills that you need to teach, like reading and writing and this, but, and you sort of focus on the fundamentals and just teach those and then only expose them to the higher level concepts, either when they need them, when they encounter them and there's an actual need, oh, teach me this so that I can apply right away, or if they're really interested in learning them. So I feel like we're going to see that shift as well. Instead of just teaching like a bunch of things that are in a curriculum, we're going to sort of focus on the fundamentals and then just dig into the other things in a need basis. And then I also think that we're starting to see a big value on failing and making mistakes and trying things out and not having them work and then trying again. And that persistence, that doesn't happen in schools. But I think that we are starting to notice how important that is and how that makes kids more resilient and make them actually like stick around longer with their ideas when they're working on them. So also that, and I think that assessment, which is such a big part of everything we do nowadays, and I'm like very against that for many reasons, but I think that it's not going to be about a grade or a test that you take, but rather what can you do with what you just learned? Like you just learned a set of skills. Show me what you can do. The way that I actually envision it. And again, there are different factors that play into it, but I think that it's going to be more like for people who do want to take this alternative path instead of going through the traditional one, you're going to have sort of like a marketplace online where you, depending on where you are and your family needs and what you're interested in your kid, you choose, you see the different options and you're going to be able to choose, let's say you want to send your kid 2 or 3 times a week to a forest school.
Yeah, my nephew goes to one of those.
Oh, yeah? Where?
In London. Yeah, but his dad is from Norway. My sister's obviously Pakistani British, but I think they're quite popular in Norway. And for my nephew, he just needs to be out. Like they took him to 12 different schools and he's only like 3-4 years old, but like he needs to be outside even in the snow. They do it.
Well, you're talking about your nephew and here's what's funny. Like all kids are like that. Like, you know, we all need like stagnation of the body, like leads to stagnation of the brain, and adults, you know, they know that too. But it's funny because with kids, what we think is, oh, they have ADHD or they're hyperactive and they can't sit still. Well, that's because that's our nature. Like we can't sit still, like, especially when we're kids. So anyway, something like a forest school is great. So let's say that you decide to send your kid to one like that, that's close to your neighborhood. Then in the afternoons, they would learn this fundamental skills through, let's say like an online school that has a cohort-based model that, you know, we've seen that works so well for adults where they're like with other peers from all over the world and they're more engaged and they're more, you know, it's like more active sort of like way of learning online. And then you can pair it up with other 2 days a week going to a micro school.
Could you explain what a micro school is? Sorry, because for people who don't know what it is.
Yes, of course. So it's sort of what we were talking about earlier of the one room schoolhouses, which are now like the new version. It's like the micro school, which are you have either an adult, it can be an educator or an interested parent that wants to work with kids that decides to host at their home or at a chapel or a church or, you know, sort of like a little center, a group of kids. And it's usually like 5 to 10 kids or 8 kids that come together and they're different ages, which is also something that is very Lindy. And I just don't know how we concluded that, you know, kids need to be learning for 12 years with kids only their age, because in the real world, you are rarely in That's a group true. With a bunch of people that are your age, right? You're interacting with older kids and younger kids and older people. So anyway, and this works really well because you have the older kids teaching the younger kids sort of wanting to act like the older kids so they learn faster. So it's just a win-win in so many situations.
Do they have a specialist subject or is it just a micro means that they're just these smaller groups?
Micro schools can go many different ways. You can either choose to follow like the school curriculum and then just teach to that, or you can choose to have, you know, create your own curriculum based on what the kids are, you know, interested or problems are trying to solve in the moment. So that's what I love about micro schools. That it gives you that flexibility. They also tend to be shorter in time. There's so much research that shows that kids don't need to be in school for 7 hours. I mean, I was a teacher and I can tell you out of the 7 hours, we were, you know, productively learning, and I'll put it in quote unquote, because I don't really think that we were learning that much, but like 2 or 3 hours a day out of the 7 hours that we were there. So, you know, micro schools sort of like tend to focus on that, like, oh, a few hours and then you're out. So I think that that's also going to be part of like this marketplace of like different things. I think that then you're also going to be able to join things like Synthesis, which is like an enrichment program that you add to your schedule, where you have kids joining online communities. Primer is also an excellent example, where you get to interact with other kids from different countries in an online environment. And I also think that we're going to see a lot of self-directed learning, like I was saying earlier. Like, kids are going to spend hours in YouTube or reading books or, you know, watching TED Talks or on rhetoric, whatever it is that they want to be doing, but they're going to be choosing where they're consuming this information. And then they're going to be, and this is also an advice that I often give to parents, not only consume, but make sure that they're producing something, whether it is a written story or maybe it's a video or anything, but that they're doing something with that information that they're choosing to consume. Those are sort of like examples. And then you plug in the music class, the sports, or whatever it is. But I think that, you know, it's going to be more like a menu, and you choose how you want to. And then that's when the personalization comes in that we were talking earlier. Like, to me, that's what a personalized learning experience looks like, when you sit down with your kid and you choose all these different things based on your needs and what your kid is interested in.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I love the vision of the marketplace, like you said, and just being able to tailor that and hopefully adapt over time as well, because again, the kid's going to change, their interest might evolve, or you might, the awareness of what they're interested in might evolve as well. I want to go into one thing you mentioned briefly earlier, which was special needs and like even autism. I don't know if autism is a form of special needs or how it exactly works, but have you got any experience with that? And are there any particular pieces of advice you have for people who have to deal with that with their kids?
Yeah. So I had a lot of experience with that, because like I said, I also majored in special ed. So I actually had to work in different placements in New York, and some of them were self-contained schools, which means that all the students that were in the school had severe, you know, the ones that I worked had really severe disabilities. So I had a lot of kids that had autism. And the thing about that is this kind of kids struggle a lot. I mean, every kid sort of like, lots of kids struggle in the traditional path, not every kid, but especially this kind of kids. You really need to find what makes them tick, and what's that thing that really, you know, engages them and that they're drawn to. They tend to be very obsessive with certain tendencies and with certain things. And that's a good thing. You find that, and then you try to see, okay, now how can I make them learn with this obsession that they have, or with this, you know, particular thing that they're drawn to. So I'm going to give you an example. In Synthesis, I spoke to a parent who was, you know, her son has autism, and you know, teachers in several different schools had told her that, you know, your kid is never going to be able to think abstractly. Like, he's going to struggle a lot. He has a very low IQ. He can't really retain information. So it's sort of like only giving her hopeless answers. And she decided to enroll him in Synthesis because he was interested in video games. That's something that she noticed. Like I said, all kids are interested in something, especially kids that have autism. They tend to obsess over something. He was obsessed with video games. So she was like, you know, Synthesis has a game-based approach. Let me try this out. And I don't know if I mentioned this at the beginning, but one of the things about Synthesis is that, you know, we don't tell kids what to do. We don't give instructions. So kids really have to figure everything out on their own. And this causes a level of healthy stress, let's put it that way, especially for kids who are used to hearing from somebody like, this is what you do, steps. Suddenly they're like thrown in this environment where they have to figure things out. Like, nobody's telling you what to do. Nobody's giving you answers. You really just have to actively figure things out. For a kid that has autism, this tends to be something that's challenging, really challenging for them. However, this boy was able to come in and just thrive in this environment. And suddenly, like, after 4 weeks of being in Synthesis, you know, the different psychologists and people that were working with him would say, wow, the progression that he's had in math, he's starting to think abstractly. He's starting to make connections. He's using the phrases that he hears his peers use in class whenever they come across an obstacle, and then using them in real life at home whenever he comes across an obstacle, which means that he's able to, you know, generalize concepts and apply them to the real world. And the mom was telling me, I've never seen this in my son. And I want to go back to all these teachers and all these people that told me that my kid would never be able to do this, and be like, I found what's right for him, and it's working for him. So for this kind of kids, it's about really, like, this parents shouldn't settle for or listen to, you know, if somebody tells you, well, your kid's not going to be able to do this, but just stop and say, okay, let me try something out. Let me keep trying until you come across what works for your kid. For this one, it was synthesis. For another kid, maybe something else, but there is a way to engage them. And every kid wants to learn. Like that's, we're born and we have this desire to learn. So it's about finding the right way to do it and to engage them in the process.
I also want to talk about learning to unlearn, because I think this is something even as adults we can all take advantage of, because there's certain things that we kind of brought up with through the schooling system and then general life as well, the workforce, and a lot of us need to unlearn certain things that we've just kind of taken for granted that are kind of simmering in the background. I think you wrote about this, or I've got it in my notes anyway, but I'll share a couple that I thought about from your writing. I'd love for you just to share your opinion or elaborate on that a little bit. The first one you mentioned was the fear of mistakes. And I think that one really resonates with me, because I think as a kid, I was, you know, in that typical mindset of, you know, like get 100% on your test. And if you get anything wrong, then you messed up. So I'm curious, like, how can people actually get out of that mindset of being afraid to make mistakes?
Well, what you experience, a lot of people, go through that. And I think that unlearning is one of the most crucial skills that we need to have nowadays, but also one of the hardest things to do, because for so many years, we've been conditioned and trained to sort of like just accept these ideas that we hear from society, from parents, from teachers in school. And then we were never trained to do what we talked about at the beginning, to question things, to not let anything in our heads unexamined, to sort of like, had we gone through that process, then we wouldn't have to unlearn that many things, right? Because you sort of like get to pick and choose what you stay with and what goes. But unfortunately, when we grow, we realize when we enter the real world, and it's funny because I've tweeted a lot about this, but I have so many examples of things that we learn in school that when you enter the real world, you're like, wait, what? Like, this is the other way around. This is not how it works. And they actually set you up for failure if you don't recognize them, if you don't figure out a way to release them and then replace them with new information or a new habit, right? So talking about this really helps, like coming, you know, realizing that a lot of these things are human constructed and things that were just imposed from generation to generation, and you don't need to believe them. So, for example, making mistakes in school, what, you know, and even if schools tell you like, yeah, we embrace mistakes, like it's not true. Like
that's
kids
true.
Are given one try and then you give them a grade. If they didn't do well, it will go in their report card. Maybe they...
Well, you get punished for it and therefore you naturally don't want to do it again.
Right. So what do you learn? You learn to fear mistakes. You learn, you know, mistakes are not good, but then you enter the real world and you see all the successful people and you look back at how they got to where they are. And it was by making thousands of mistakes and learning from them and then getting up and trying again. We don't learn this in school. This is something that, so it's so important to unlearn that mistakes are a negative thing, and you know, mistakes are a bad thing. Like we need to unlearn that and sort of relearn that no, actually mistakes are part of the process. You're bound to make some mistakes. And of course you can avoid some. As long as you learn from them, then you're good. So that's like one thing very, very important that we need to unlearn. The other one, in school, they teach you to fit in, and they teach you that you sort of, you know, you need to aspire to do certain things, and this is the road to get to success, and this is what you do, and here are your role models, and it's sort of like, you know, you're put into this box, and then if you try things that are a little bit different, then you sort of get in trouble. Those who dare to think differently or to take a different route or try something, it's like, no, that's wrong. You're a troublemaker. When in reality, you know, we're training people to think the same way, to solve problems the same way. Like, what's unique about that? Like, we don't, you know, there's nothing original there. So you leave school, you enter the real world, you want to come up with something original. You haven't been trained to do that. You're trained to think like everyone else. You're trained to fit in. And in the real world, you're better off standing out. So that's another mind shift and something else that you need to unlearn. Like, it's okay to think differently and to try different things.
But I guess this also, to be objective about it, for our education system to change and for us to value standing out, and value not fitting in, like we also, like the teachers have to believe in that across the board, right? Because, and maybe that trickles down, I'm not sure how that would work, but to become a teacher, you usually have to go through like the similar process And in a way, you're kind of fitting in into that process. So like the way you guys are doing at Synthesis is different because you're probably hiring people that are trying to do things in new ways. But I guess the traditional system doesn't necessarily do that. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they are in some cases. So I'm curious, like, to do this at scale would require like a whole approach to the way we hire teachers too, or at least train teachers, I guess.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? At Synthesis, a lot of the people and the facilitators that we hire, they're not teachers. There are some that are, but there's some that are not. There's some that are, and I actually think this is wonderful, that just have a, you know, they want to work, they have the desire, they want to work with kids, they want to try something new. They're very knowledgeable in something specific, and they're willing to, we always say, like, you need to be willing to unlearn everything you've heard in the textbook and this and that, and just come in with a fresh mind, you know, and focus on what we know is true, those fundamental truths, and then build up from there. And I think that that's more effective in the long run, because when you've been trained again a specific way and you sort of like just follow the motions, you end up doing what everyone's doing, right? Mm. And you end up producing kits that do the same. So to me, it's even better. And I've spoken about this when I took two online courses for the first time. That one's called Rite of Passage by David Prell, and the other one's called Building a Second Brain by Tiago Forte. And these were the first cohort-based online courses that I took, and they stuck with me because they were doing things very differently from teachers in general. Like I know how teachers plan for a lesson, how they get ready, how they organize. And they, both of them, they hadn't been teachers before. And because of that, I think that they were able to bring something to the table that was completely new, very effective. Yes, they thought about what would work, like what would work for me. Now let's try that. They weren't really basing off from what's been done in the past. And I think that there's a lot of merit to that, and a lot of, you know, so, which is also why I decided to try things out of the system instead of trying to like work within the system, because then we would, you know, a lot of what looks like innovation there is not really innovation. You're sort of like doing more of what's already been done and maybe tweaking it a little bit, but that's not change. And that's not necessarily effective.
Yeah. And I think from just my vantage point as well, like the people I've interviewed on the show and met, many of the most innovative people came from completely different worlds. And because of that, they had this fresh pair of eyes. So Scott Harrison, episode 2 of the podcast, right in the beginning, was a nightclub promoter for 10 years. And then now has kind of revolutionized the nonprofit world because he completely didn't learn how things actually work. And he just designed it from scratch. The founder of Square was on the show. He was an artist. And he said, well, why does it cost so much money to process a credit card? And then he ended up creating Square. So I think there's definitely merit to that. I do think, of course, people who are in the system, of course, they have like great specialist knowledge that can be really useful to combine together. But maybe designing from scratch, completely radical new ways of doing things is a real big benefit if you don't necessarily come from within that system. So talking of which, let's talk a little bit about Synthesis, because this is what you've been working on more recently. So could you just give a little bit of a backstory on what it is? I think Elon Musk is involved in some way, or like I've heard you mention it anyway. So curious his involvement too.
Well, basically Elon Musk saw the same thing that you see, that I see, that we've been talking about, which is that schools are outdated and they're not really preparing kids for the kinds of jobs that we need in the future. And more than that, they're not helping kids think for themselves and solve real problems, which is what, you know, we should be doing, or guiding them to what's your edge and what are you going to do with that. So he was like, well, I don't have time to, you know, create my own and start my own school, but I'm going to tap into someone that he trusted a lot. His name is Josh Dan. He was the teacher at the school where he had his kids at the time. Phenomenal guy. I work with him now. We call him a creative genius, even though he doesn't love to hear that, but he really is. And he understands kids really well and knows what makes them tick. And he hired Josh, and together they came up with like this sort of like, you know, they try to rethink education from first principles, which means, okay, let's go down to basics. Let's forget about what's in the textbook, what works, but no, let's brainstorm what actually works. And they went through those questions that we talked about at the beginning. What do we know about kids and about what engages them? What have we seen that kids are really drawn to? Oh, they love games. Okay, so whatever we do, games need to be involved. Oh, they're when they're engaged, they seem to remember things. Okay, so engagement is a priority. When you give them things that are complex, they can actually do that and they actually crave complexity. Oh, but in school, it's the opposite. In school, we water things down so that it's easier to grade. And because we think that, you know, but actually no, kids want things that are challenging. They want when you challenge, you know, they enjoy when you challenge them creatively. So let's make sure that whatever it is that we do in this school, that it's very challenging and complex, but at the same time manageable so that they can, you know, they can do it and they can get better at it. So they came up with like a whole list of like principles that they wanted to base off this school. And then Josh was the director and the creator of the school. It was only 50 kids. It was Elon's kids and then other SpaceX employees, like their children. And it was called Ad Astra, which means to the stars. And it was in the SpaceX campus. It started 2014. And it was sort of like a lab school. So, you know, the teachers, again, many of them were like NASA engineers and like things like that, like really interesting
people. That's pretty cool for a kid to have that access.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the most interesting thing was the way that they would teach the subject. So he was always like trying to bring it back to the real world and making sure that there was an application that the kids knew why they're learning what they're learning. One of the things we spoke about at the beginning, a big problem with education is that kids don't see the purpose of it. So, right. So they're just, and when you don't see the purpose for something, your mind won't be there. But here, like they understood why they were learning the things that they were learning and what they could do that was so cool with this thing. So the engagement levels was like really high. And then the beauty of this school or the most popular class was this course called Synthesis, that Josh was the teacher of this course and the one who created, which was, okay, how can we teach kids to solve complex problems, like the kinds of problems that Elon wants their kids to solve, right? Like he wanted to create the next, you know, Tesla employees or, you know, SpaceX employees. Well, how can we teach them that through games and through game simulations? So he designed like over 50 games that had wrinkles and wrinkles and wrinkles of complexity, and that forced kids to make ethical decisions at different points and then reflect on their choices and change their mind and work collaboratively. There were elements of competition, but a lot of collaboration. And it was just the perfect mix to get kids engaged. There was always like an element of surprise in every game. So the kids never know what to expect because you want to teach kids, like our world, again, chaotic, always changing. So you want to put kids in an environment where it's a bit chaotic. So they experience that and they learn how to navigate that. That is complex. Our world is very complex. And then you give them the tools and you guide them to sort of like, how do you deal with this now? So anyway, he came up with a bunch of those games. And then a few years later, when Elon's kids graduated last spring, Ad Astra moved out of SpaceX and changed its name to AstraNova. And then, this other guy called Chris Minfrank, who used to work at Class Dojo, another edtech company, you know, came to the school and told Josh, why don't we grab Synthesis, which is really the heart of this school, and we try to scale that. We put it on, you know, on an internet, like online, and we designed the software and the platforms to make it accessible online in the virtual world. So they started testing that, and they hired a group of game designers and engineers, and they also like tapped to me to sort of like help them bring this vision to the world. And so that's what we've been doing. And what we are starting off, yeah, we so far have two game simulations. And we call them games, but really they're more like simulations because they're very much like the real world. And the kids are learning different things in this high-paced environment. We don't, you know, unlike school, like we don't put them like a limit. So kids can really move at their pace. They're meeting kids from other parts of the world and it's very student-centered. So it's been very exciting. We have different ideas of where this could go. We're just getting started. We don't even have 6 months since we launched. And the cool thing is that we are evolving with the things that we see that are necessary. So we are very open to feedback. We're in constant communication with our community of parents who trusted us with their kids in this like journey. And we're constantly looking for what are successful people out there doing and how did they get there? And we listen to them and we sort of try to pick on things that we could be teaching kids since they're younger. That's how we came with this idea of teaching kids mental models so that they can actually apply them in the real world, which are like these patterns that they can use to solve problems and make decisions in the real world. And kids love it because we're treating them not like kids. We're treating them like adults, like they matter. We're teaching them things that they clearly see why they're learning them. And they're like, this makes sense. So they're engaged, they're having fun, and it's been working really, really well. So we'll see where this goes.
Well, that sounds super exciting. I saw online that the approach to Sumrise was like play, reflect, connect. And I really love that, like flipping the other way around, which you mentioned earlier. Just to actually paint a picture, is this just online, right? Or
yeah,
there's nothing in person, which nowadays nothing's in person anyway. So that makes sense. And maybe you guys were already planning for that. But what age group is this for? Is it, I'm assuming this is like a private school equivalent that costs money and from certain, is it from one country or how does it work?
No. So because it's online, we've been able to open it up to the entire world. So we have kids from all over the world. And that's why we have like times, we have games and cohorts in different time zones, depending on where you are in the world. And we decided, so the age group is 7 through 14, and that's also the age of Ad Astra. So Elon and Josh Dand had decided that that's sort of like the critical period where kids are old enough to start learning about these high level concepts, but still young enough to be malleable and to sort of like adopt and learn a new way to think, right? So the idea is that if you go through this program from 7 to 14, those crucial years, you learn, you're just wired differently from kids that are your age. You learn how to, you know, operate differently, how to think differently, and you sort of have an edge, right? So that's why we chose that age. And it's for girls, it's for boys, like everyone, and just open to anyone. It is, we are charging now, again, things are going to be changing because we just got started, but it's a subscription model so that kids actually get to stick around for all these years. And, you know, we keep adding different elements to what Synthesis is. It's like a community that you're opting in. And so they pay, so they pay an amount of money a month and then they get to play the different game simulations with a cohort. But now we're going to be adding, so it's going to be sort of like a triangle, like different components. So we are going to, we're working to have like a free version so that kids from all over the world can actually, that have access to a computer and internet can benefit from playing sorts, you know, our games and learning how to think differently in a fun way. And then we're going to have, we're going to keep adding different components to our, we're not going to call it a school and we're not going to call it a curriculum because we really are not that, but it's hard to find a word to explain to parents what we do.
And just to clarify, so this is on top of going to a school, right? Like, so this isn't replacing school at the moment. Maybe 10 years from now, it might be different, but so this is the same way I might've gone to Kumon as a kid to learn extra math or whatever. But you guys have created these worlds online that people can send their kids to learn through games, meet other kids, meet expert teachers. And how many people are enrolled in this at the moment?
We actually just sort of paused subscription for a moment. So we have 600, like almost 600 kids subscribed monthly. So, and again, we just got started, but we sort of decided to pause for a little bit because we want to make sure that we continue to, you know, as we scale, that the student experience is really solid, that we're really providing all these things that we're seeing, that we're doing, and also getting lots of feedback and building as we go. We're a very small team of 5 people. So in addition to teaching kids through game simulations, this really is like, we want to create like the ultimate like learning community for kids, for ambitious kids who want to work on interesting things, that want to meet kids that are also interested in the same things that they are. And we sort of think of it, I mean, in the future, the way we sort of, it's like, you know, YC, Y Combinator, sort of something like that for kids. And we are thinking about, you know, having like getting a space where we can build an infrastructure and have actually like kids come a few times a year to sort of like work on interesting projects together and meet in person and sort of like to add that in-person component. But right now what we are, yes, it's an enrichment program. A few hours a week. Eventually we will move into something more, but we are not quite sure if that's going to mean a full-time institution or sort of like always part of this marketplace that I was talking about earlier where you can, it's part of your education.
That's brilliant. And just so if people are listening and they've got kids and they're interested in joining eventually when it reopens for more people, how much does it cost a month roughly?
Yeah, it's $180 a month. And we are looking to bring that price down as we, you know, add more kids and add more things. But for now, that's, it's $180 a month.
That's awesome. And yeah, I can imagine the different layers. There'll be the free version, which anyone can gain from. And then, I mean, even $180 is not that crazy if you think about like sometimes you pay that for a tutor who helps you one-on-one after school and stuff like that.
And we do have a Discord community for the kids, sort of like to keep building the community, because the kids have really made friends with each other and they want to keep playing, they want to keep engaging. So eventually what we're working toward now is having some games that the kids can actually run themselves in the platform of Discord, where you don't really need that adult involved. So that's also something interesting that we're working toward.
You just brought up an interesting point there, which is about online versus offline. So we talked about the Forest score earlier and how that can be really great for a lot of kids. And I think my understanding is both of these are important, right? Like we want kids to also be adaptable to the real world, spend time away from their phones and devices, play, you know, be in nature, all that sort of stuff. But also realistically, we're all using computers and we need to understand how to work collaboratively online, especially nowadays. So I'm curious how you think about that balance between screen time, essentially, where a lot of parents right now are trying to reduce screen time for kids, and also making sure that they're comfortable and literate with computers as well.
Yeah. I think it's exactly what you said. It's about finding that right balance. So right now we're sort of like in a different situation because schools are mostly online. So it's tricky right now to talk about that balance. But in the future, once we are sort of like out of all this, I think that the learning component is not going to go away, especially those that did remote learning, which is not the same as online learning. Remote learning is sort of like grabbing what you were doing in the physical space and just sort of like putting it online.
Similar to the gamification thing you mentioned before. It's not designed for that environment.
Exactly. I think that, yeah, that's not going to last, because if it's torture for teachers, for parents, for students, like, you know, it's been really challenging. But for those people that have designed online courses or online programs that are specifically designed for an online audience, those are not going to go away. And that's sort of like synthesis, right? I think that, again, that doesn't mean, whenever I talk about online education, people ask me always, I'm like, well, what do you mean? You want for my kid to be in front of the computer the entire day? I'm like, no. First of all, your kid doesn't need to be, you know, receiving direct instruction in order to be learning the entire day, right? Just a few hours. So it's about, you know, let's say that you do 3 hours of screen time a day, and two of them are in this cohort based models or this programs like Synthesis. And then you have that other extra hour to either play video games in a productive way, and we can talk about that later, or to actually like look, you know, self-education, like you're watching YouTube videos or you're connecting with peers in your online communities. So as long as there's like a purpose behind what you're doing when you're using the internet and you're using it to learn, and then you have the time outside to actually talk in person to other people and reflect on your experiences, then I think you're fine, right? I also think it's super important that parents know that kids are consuming from the internet, yes, but also from books. Really important to, you know, really foster that love for reading, and for kids to know that that's also a very valuable source of information that they can get from there.
Are there any different types of schools that you've seen that have been quite interesting, and what makes them interesting to you?
Yeah, so I'm really drawn to this progressive approach to education, and this, you know, you have schools like the Montessori school, like Reggio Emilia schools or the Waldorf schools. These are all again, progressive education approach. And they all sort of believe, or they're grounded in the belief that, you know, it's really about the kid, and they're very flexible in their approach. And they really believe that the kid is able to do a lot of the learning on their own if they are engaged, they're playing, they're in the right environment. And I love, like, for example, if you look at Synthesis borrows a lot of the same ideas that you have in this kind of schools and in this kind of like progressive approaches, which is, it's student-centered. The role of the educator is more like a facilitator and an instigator, where you're posing questions and sort of like, you know, inspiring kids. This idea of letting, like trusting that the kids will figure things out, that's a big theme in this progressive philosophy. And I truly believe that, because I've seen what kids are capable of doing when you actually give them the time, the space, and the resources. Like, it's incredible. Like, they really can do so many things without our help. Have you heard of I think it's called the Blue School in New York, and it was actually created by the guys, the Blue Man Group. And it's all around like creativity and innovation and this, and it's amazing. And the facilities are beautiful. But then again, it's very limited to the kids that they have. You also have like the Sudbury schools, which are more like radical and like in the spectrum, because they're very like the kids are doing it all. Like the kids are in charge, the kids like do the whole thing. And I think and I think it's great, but it's right. It's like
sounds
really
like
going to the extreme. right. So that's also interesting. And you see many schools that are more geared, they look more like vocational schools, where kids are actually like, they have mentors and they're sort of like guiding them to find what they're good at. And then sort of like having them do a lot of that since they're younger. And I also find that super interesting. So anything that goes along those lines, when parents ask me, I'm always like, try to stay away from the institutions, what I said earlier, right? Like try to go for those more personalized schools.
Yeah, I love that. And you brought up a topic there, which I think is interesting to talk about, which is kind of universal access to this sort of education or the best education wherever it moves. And I think that in all of these sorts of things, as things evolve and there's more interesting stuff happening on the cusp of, you know, the innovative stuff happening in education, most of the time the people who get access to that, understandably in one way, are kind of rich kids, right? Because the parents can afford to spend money and send them to these sorts of schools. And obviously I'm generalizing, there's incredible, I went to regular public school, and I'm all for public schools if they're good. I'm curious, like, your take on how do we ensure that there's access for everyone, not just necessarily kids who have rich parents?
Right. So I think that that's the problem that everyone's trying to solve for. And I don't think there's an answer to that. What I do think is, and it ties back to, for example, why I left the school system, because I was, you know, the little work that I was able to do and the change that I was able to do, it was only 20 kids in front of me. These people that are like going out and creating this amazing, really cool and progressive schools, limited to a few kids that can pay for it. So when I think about, okay, what's the, like, how can I really, you know, contribute and make sure that whatever I'm doing or building or working toward benefits more than just 20 kids or the kids that have the money to pay for it. That's why I turned to the internet, to be honest, because people sometimes criticize and they're like, well, but not everyone has a computer. People in these really rural areas, they don't have internet, right? But they also don't have access to these amazing schools that they're building in New York and in California.
Yeah.
So if you think of where we're heading, I think that more and more rural communities will end up having internet. Like that's something more doable in my mind than opening this amazing schools everywhere. So if we're able to figure out, and again, so many limitations online and you know, I am aware of all the, you know, things and factors we need to take into consideration. But if I'm betting on something, it really is the internet.
I think because technology is deflationary, so it brings down the prices of things on average. And as more people get access, like you said, to smartphones, there's already, I think, 4 billion people with access to the internet through phones, at least. If you have that massive layer, which is free, and, you know, there's already Khan Academy, there's YouTube, what you guys are building on the free side. So hopefully that would help.
Right. So I am very optimistic about that and about giving kids that, you know, don't have the means access to the internet, not only so that they're part of things like Synthesis, but also because a kid with a phone or with an internet connection can automatically be a creator, right? Like they just need their imagination to figure things out and they can put things out in the world that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do. So I'm really bullish with like everything that has to do with the internet and figuring out the best way to do it. We're still far from the optimal conditions, but I think that we're doing some really good work in this space.
As you've kind of studied education around the world and experienced it firsthand, what can we borrow from other parts of the world that we could potentially apply in the US? And then after this, we'll do the other way around as well, what we do well here.
Yeah, so again, if we're talking about like specific systems, I don't think that there's like a country in the world that has like the system that everyone should turn to and that they're doing things really well, which is, you know, part of why I'm like doing something to the side. But I do feel like there's some things that we can, like at least some attitude or some mindsets that we can adopt from different countries. And for example, people talk often about Finland and the system that they have in Finland. And I don't think it's so much about the system. I think it's more about a mentality that they have that we don't have in the US. It's pretty much the opposite. And it's this idea that less is more. So in the US, a big problem that we have is that we just keep adding things to our plate. And we think that the solution to everything is to adding more homework, more hours in a day, you know, more tests and more and more and more and more, right? More lessons and more subjects. And we think that by doing that and raising the standards and this, like, kids are going to be learning more and we're going to fix their problems. In Finland, they actually think the opposite. So if you look at the way that their system is structured, the kids, first of all, they start school when they're 7 years old, which I think is great, because the kids up to their seven, they get to enjoy their childhood. They get to really like learn in this more organic ways through play, et cetera, before they go into an institution. So they really think that, you know, less years in school is better. They also actually spend less time in school. So school starts around 9 a.m. and they go to like 2 p.m. and then teachers and students can leave right away. They don't have to stick around like we have to do in the U.S. But also during that time the kids are in school, it's not like in the U.S. where teachers are teaching 6+ subjects and lessons a day. Like that was me. Teachers here teach about 4 or less classes, and kids have multiple breaks of like significant breaks between the classes to go outside, to stretch, to move around, to sort of like digest what they're doing. And it's a lot less instruction, like instructional time. And, you know, in this side of the world, we're sort of like, whoa, like they're wasting time, but not really. Like they're actually using time productively, right? Kids have time for what really matters. They don't really have that many tests like we do in the US. They have less homework. They have less subjects. And I thought this was so crazy. If you look at their curriculum, like I was a fourth and third and fourth grade teacher in the US and I taught math and like among the other subjects. So when I look at the math curriculum and you look at what the kids cover in Finland from grades fifth grade all the way to ninth grade, in all those years, it's the same amount of content that we cover in 1 year in the US. It is crazy. And it goes back to this idea of in Finland, they really think we're not going to cram kids and like try to expose them to everything. They're not going to be using this right now. Like, let's just teach them the fundamentals and let's do it really well. And let's make sure that we do it in a way where it actually sticks. And then the kids get to a point where they're 16, where they get to choose between three tracks in Finland. They get either go to upper school, or they can go into vocational studies, or they can actually enter the workforce. Not a lot of them do that, but they have the option. And so, you know, it's a more like they really value and understand that when you have less, really you're gaining more, and you don't really see that in the US. So I think that that's something that if we could sort of emulate and sort of understand how valuable that is, that would be great. That would be great if we had less time in school and less things to do and less, you know, it would just be beneficial for the students and for the teachers as well.
Just to wrap things up, I guess if you have any advice for parents around some specific scenarios, I was thinking that are quite common. So one is letting kids find what they love and encouraging them to keep exploring that. Is there advice you have for parents to kind of nurture that in a way?
Knowing everything we've spoken about today, that schools are not really concerned with this, and that, you know, even if your kid does go to a traditional school, if you do provide the right support at home, then they are going to be okay, right? They are going to be able to access all these things that we've been talking about. So the first thing that I always think about is make sure that they join a community of learners, whether it's a virtual one or, you know, around their environment or anything, a physical one, but where they can really share what they're learning with other peers and surround themselves with peers that they are choosing to be friends with and be part of, right? Not just who they're stuck with in school. Like people, because I've seen that when kids learn with other kids, that just really accelerates the learning and the desire to keep learning, and it motivates them in a way that they're not motivated with adults. So really try to find that community that where your kids excel. And again, you can look at something like synthesis, or you can look at something like primer, and they're meant, and these ones are virtual, but you know, you can sort of like find that. But also get them to ask questions about everything, right? So whenever, and reinforce that whenever someone says something, it doesn't matter who it is. It's okay to say, let me think about this and let me see, you know, what I think. Let me try to figure out how much of this is true.
Not having an answer straight away necessarily.
Exactly. Yeah. And that it's okay to question things and sort of like incentivize that. The other thing that I say, and you know, when I say this, people are like, well, every parent believes in their kids. And no, every parent loves their kids. But loving your kid and believing in your kid is not the same thing. And I've, you know, there's this really good book called Raising Entrepreneurs. I think that's the name of the book. And the author sort of like interviews the parents of a bunch of successful entrepreneurs out there. And the one thing that, you know, they all have in common is that they all supported their kids with whatever crazy wild ideas and obsessions that they had with kids. They made sure, sort of like my mom, to nurture that and to, you know, make them understand that if they're really passionate and they work really hard, they can figure out a way to make this into a living and they can make a difference. And sort of, you know, sometimes parents are like, oh, but my kid likes video games. Like, I'm not going to support that. And it's like, wait, well, what do you mean? If your kid is really good in video games, like, video games is a multi-billion-dollar business. And there's so many positions that they can have and so many things that they can do, you know, that they offer work. So it's like, before saying no, like, stop and really see what they're interested in and what they're passionate about and make sure you support that and you nurture that, whether it is enrolling them in a class so that they keep learning or in a community or, but really support them and believe in them.
What about, you know, kids who are behaving badly or maybe have become a little spoiled? Because that's quite a hard thing to reverse. And maybe a part of that, I don't know if that's just like the way the kid is or how much is based on how the parents have brought them up and their environment. So have you got any advice for any parents who are dealing with that as well?
Yeah, what I've noticed, again, I've worked with many, many kids, and I've had many kids who teachers would label troublemakers. What I've noticed is they're not, like, when a kid is causing some trouble, two things are happening. Either the kid is just not interested in what you're forcing them to do. And usually when they're not interested is because you haven't explained why you're forcing them to do what you're forcing them to do. So having conversations where you explain, even if it's obvious to you, you're like, why would I explain this? My kid knows this. No, like, you need to stop and actually walk them through, explain why you're doing what you're doing or why this consequence, like talking through things and helping them understand things is so beneficial for kids who are troublemakers, right? Or who, you know, they usually just don't understand. And when you don't see the purpose for something, you don't want to do it. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, a lot of these kids tend to be the kids that the path, you know, the traditional path just doesn't work for them. So I always say this, like, to parents, if your kid is happy in school and they're learning, even if it's not the most fun thing ever, but they're learning, then that's fine. You know, that's fine. But if your kid is misbehaving or is not into it or is telling you that they don't like it, and then you need to stop and start looking for alternatives. Like, listen to the kids. Like, usually where people just disregard, like, oh, they're just kids, but really, like, they know what they're talking about.
They're showing, like, what they care about through their actions too, I guess.
Yeah. Exactly. And remembering, like, parents will remember that a lot of the things that we do in school don't make a lot of sense. Like, having them sit down for so many hours, having them not talk, like this, you know. So if there's a kid that is standing up and talking, you know, as a parent, that that is normal. Unfortunately, they're in an institution where that's not allowed, but it's normal. So I just invite parents to rethink, when they think that they have a troublemaker, to sort of like see what are the reasons, like dig deeper.
Last thing to wrap us up, you've got an incredible stack of books behind you. And we talked about this on Twitter a few weeks ago about your favorite books, but specifically for kids. So I'm curious, are there like two or three that you might have gifted the most to other parents? Or yeah, maybe we start with that one. Like, if you're, are there a few that you'd say there's a new, someone's just had a baby, I want to buy them a book or two? Like, is there a few that stand out to you?
Yeah, so I sort of thought that you were going to ask this because of a tweet that you wrote the other day. So I have here a few that I wanted to share. But instead of going like, again, I have a huge stack collection of books. I don't have kids yet, but I love them because I feel like there's so many different lessons that you can grab from this. But I'm going to talk about sort of like a few different categories and then give examples of books that fit into that category. Because again, a lot of books can fulfill the same purpose, right? So I love the books that encourage kids to think about the kind of person that they want to be and sort of like that begin building that character. And there are tons of books like this. And there are two here by one of my favorite authors. Her name's Catherine Otoshi. One of them is called One and the other one's called Zero. And they're both around, you know, like self-esteem and finding value in yourself and standing up for yourself. And it's sort of like that category of books that start to, when kids are younger, they're learning from everything, right? They're learning from teachers, from mentors, they're learning from books. So really finding books that sort of like have these values and that encourage them to think differently about themselves are really, really interesting to me.
And what age are those books for, roughly?
Right. So here's the thing. Again, I told you I taught third and fourth grade last. I've also taught first grade, and my book collection, I would recommend to kids like all the way to fourth grade, the ones that I'm going to talk about right now, except for one that's for older. But you can, again, these are books that even if an adult reads them, they're going to extract the same purpose. So really, I it's about the message and how you read it and how you engage with it. But this is probably, for younger elementary, let's put it that way. Then I also like the books that have characters that exercise their creativity in pursuit of unique accomplishments. So because what I've noticed is that these books elevate the aspirations of the kids. So here's an example. This one's called Rosie Revere Engineer. And it's about the story of Rosie who dreamed of becoming like a really good engineer. And then she had like all these different obstacles. And I love it because girls in particular, the ones that are interested in doing things a little bit differently, are really into this book. So I love books that sort of like get you, inspire you to sort of pursue this kind of things. Then obviously the books that emphasize like creative and original achievements and that also not only highlight like the accomplishments and everything that went well, but that also go into the struggles and the failures and all the times that things did not go right, because I feel like kids learn more from that than from just reading, oh, this person did so well. Like, no, like let's go into what really matters so that they know what to expect. And this one's called Fantastically Great Women Who Changed the World. And it's actually like the real stories of a lot of successful women. So that one I also really like. Then books that sort of like have characters that perform things that you would never think that are possible, because they sort of make kids imagine. We talked about how a lot of the problem with the things that we learn in school is that it sets boundaries as to what we can do and what can't do. So when we start to unlearn these things and think from first principles, suddenly like the world is full of possibilities and the kids are like, wait, so I can do this. So this is a book, and there's actually a documentary and a movie on this called Man on Wire, but the book is called The Man Who Walked Between the Towers.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Now, of course, I'm not incentivizing kids to go ahead and do this. This is crazy. But, and I talk about that when I'm reading this book. But I think it's, you know, it shows when someone has like an obsession and they really want to accomplish something and they work really hard, then they can do the impossible, the unimaginable. So those kind of books.
That's amazing.
And then I could go on and on and on. I'm going to talk about one more. I have like a bunch here, but just, but then there, this book is for older kids. It's called Wonder. Although I did read it with my fourth grade class one time, but I would say if you read it with a parent, you can do third, fourth grade. If not, maybe a little bit higher. But I love this book and the kinds of books that sort of like make you more empathetic toward others. So Wonder by RJ Palacio is about like this character called Augie that has sort of like a people discriminate against him because he has a face disability. But the story is narrated in a way that the kids really get to connect and with the character, and they become more like less prejudiced against other people that have disabilities in their lives. So books that cause that kind of sentiment to me are really, 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 yeah, really good.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. That was a great list. And then what I'll do is after this, you can send me a list if that's okay with, if you have any others, and I'll include that in the show notes. So if you're listening in the podcast or watching,
I can talk about this forever.
Yeah, no, I'd love to share that out for people. So if you're on YouTube, just go in the description, and on the podcast in the show notes, I'll have a list if you're interested in any of these as well. So listen, Miss Fab, thank you so much for educating me today on this topic. And yeah, this has been incredible. I think we went through so many great topics. I think people are going to love this. Is there anything we want to wrap up with? Anywhere we should be sending people? Your Anna Fabrega 11 on Twitter, which is on the screen right now, and synthesis.is is the website. Anywhere else we'd like to take people to?
Well, if you're a parent and you're interested in sort of like the ideas that I'm exploring, I do have a weekly newsletter. Almost every Friday it goes out. I'll say almost because sometimes life gets in the way. But yeah, it's called Fab Fridays. You can subscribe at afabrega.com. And yeah, that's sort of like I share what I'm building, what I'm thinking about. And again, I mostly like raise questions and talk about things that will get you to think about education in a new way. I don't think that I have neatly packed answers, but it's just a way to start moving into the right direction and giving parents and educators tips of things they can do with their kids, regardless of their education situation.
Amazing. Yeah, we'll put that on the screen as well and in the show notes too. So just click through and sign up for that. Thanks again for coming on. This has been amazing. I'd love to do this again in the future, and really appreciate everything you shared today.
Thank you, Bilal. This has been a great conversation. Thank you for asking great questions.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.